Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content, no matter what your budget is. Today is November 14th, 2016. I believe this is episode 27, and let's take a moment.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. All right, I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Hey everybody, Patrick Norton here.
Hey, and Robert Heron.
And you may be wondering, where have we been for the last month?
Away. And about.
Well, I've mostly been shoveling dirt, although I did make it to Rocky Mountain Audio Fest. You went to China after...
I did. And Hong Kong.
And Hong Kong.
And surrounding areas.
And Chicago.
And yeah, a few months back. Yeah.
It bleeds together.
Probably wasn't that long ago.
The shoveling dirt confuses me. We apologize. We're still working out our mobile production thing. But we are dedicated, ladies and gentlemen, listening to AVXL right now to get you a podcast every week between now and CES to get our weekly production on properly. And this Thursday, ladies and gentlemen, 11/17/2016, we will have a hangout, and I believe we'll try to have another one the weekend after that.
Perfect.
How about Black Friday weekend?
Perfect.
Saturday the 26th. That
the day
good?
I recommend you stay home.
Yeah. Well, the 25th would be the day you recommend people stay home.
Anywho,
keep an eye on your email box for
your invitation
to that. We're just going to invite everybody to those.
Video goodness.
If you have a question about Black Friday, just fire it out. Generally speaking, I don't think any of our television suggestions or recommendations are going to change.
Not really. No. It's more about, you know, effective shopping technique, I think, more than anything, really. Just knowing that when you walk out or you hit that buy button or however you want to do it, you're going to get a good deal on something you're actually wanting, not just buying something just because, oh, this happens to be the cheapest so-and-so size, such-and-such, whatever.
And
so,
if you see a brand name that maybe, say, is associated with instant cameras from 25 years ago or television brands that haven't been made in the last decade showing up at Black Friday for a supreme discount, understand that that is rebranding, and you know it may be a great product, but more than likely it's a crappy product that has a name that looks kind of familiar that's designed to confuse you just a little bit.
I would say in my recent travels too, I would say that my lesson learned as far as shopping goes is know in your head, basically know what it is that you want, and so you're not just buying stuff, but also know what you would pay for something before you actually buy it, and have that price in mind. So be it your max price or just, hey, here's what I would like to get this particular thing at that price. How close is it to it? Or
Shannon Snubbs Morse Law of Black Friday shopping is know what you want, know what it's priced at, and then know what a real sale is. Because there are, ladies and gentlemen, retailers out there who have been known to elevate prices just in time to, quote, discount them, unquote, for that big, well, it's actually, I guess it's Black Friday, Cyber Monday, and now I'm hearing about Cyber Saturday or Cyber Weekend.
It's just this whole period of the year.
It's about selling. We'll get into that later.
I heard you made your way to Colorado.
Denver, Colorado, Rocky Mountain Audio Fest. It's really cool. I've read about it for years. It's an annual gathering in Denver, and I should look up, I apologize, I should know the name of the group that puts it on, but mostly I know Rocky Mountain Audio Fest. And they took over a hotel, or most of a hotel. The hotel didn't tell the organizers of Rocky Mountain Audio Fest that they weren't quite finished with the renovation. So all the headphone stuff was in a tent, kind of in the front parking lot.
Well, the weather was probably nice.
The weather was nice. It was actually really nice. The guys in the tent were a little worried the first day because, you know, you could see holes in the top of the big banquet tent where you could see the sunshine through, and there was a diesel generator that went out for a little bit on the first morning of the show. But it takes place in October in Denver, Colorado, and you know, they call it this is the 13th annual, quote, the largest consumer audio and home entertainment show in the United States. Can Jam at RMAF is essentially the head-fi.org crew put together their headphone festival. It's really cool.
What was your favorite thing you saw there? Like, you put it on and just said, okay, this was unexpected.
Probably.
Could you name one? Or just something off the wall?
Man, I saw a lot of things. No. Probably the thing that surprised me the most was the crew at Odyssey, right? So Odyssey makes planar magnetic headphones.
Oh.
Earlier this summer, they released the Sign on-ear headphones, which, you know, sound really expensive.
How do you spell that company name?
A-U-D-E-E. Eazy-E.
Eazy-E.
It's kind of a phonetic spelling, yeah.
Gotcha.
So they've done, they started with Over-Ear, the EL8 series, the LCD collection, you know, and these are typically like, you know, $2,000, $3,000. I think they're top line. Yeah, their LCD 4 is like a $4,000 set of headphones. You know, they started doing some less expensive stuff. One of the ones that really stood out is they came out with the Sign, which is an on-ear headphone for about $500. And it's essentially sealed on the outside. I talked about these earlier this summer, and they sound fantastic. Very, very small, very, very travel-friendly. Because usually when you get planar magnetics, whether you're talking about, you know.
Picture big.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, it looks like a dessert
boxes
cup. Yeah, like a like a Big Mac, or you know, you know, help me, Obi-Wan. Your
not
Danish is trapped
public transit
the
with these,
head.
Or slipping them in my pocket or anything. So
you can ride public transit with open-backed over-ear.
Actually, you probably should
planar magnetics. Well, you hear everything from outside, okay. Right? Whether you're talking about Odyssey's LCD,
gotcha.
Or Hi-Fi Man or Mr. Speakers, but the vast majority of planar magnetics traditionally are big open-backed headphones. So they came out with a Sign this summer, which was their on-ear one with the sealed back. And then I did not know it was coming. They had an in-ear headphone, the iSign 10 and the iSign 20, and they sounded fantastic. They're a little, you know, they're not earbuds. It's kind of like a, it looks like a, sort of like a, you know, something in between a spider web about the size of a 50-cent piece. With a thing you stick inside of your ear.
A cone funneling the audio into your
literally.
Ear hole.
You know, those are
ear canal.
They're selling for $400 or $600 in their pre-orders.
Unlike a lot of the in-ear headphones or in-ear phones we look at where they have the tiny drivers that are right inside of you.
These are not tiny.
Yeah, these are on the outside. The driver's outside and it's...
These are big drivers.
Coning the audio. Funnel.
Pretty much. It's a
cool,
30 millimeter planar magnetic diaphragm.
Yeah, you're not getting that in your ear.
No. Easy to drive. No troubles driving them off my phone. No troubles driving them off my Astell and Kern. No trouble driving them off my Fio audio player. Fantastic sounding audio. I'm not sure.
Were they easy to put on, take on, and put off? Or you know, sometimes folks have issues with that, or just straight up comfort for longevity.
I got like 10 minutes with them, right? Because you got
to
understand, there's discrete rooms with speakers and hi-fi gear set up in various suites in the hotel.
And you're just running around like a mad person.
Yeah, and they basically had long rows of tables with people with their headphone gear on them. So, you know, part of the reason I wanted to go there. Oh, I should also say one of the things I saw that I'd heard about but hadn't had a chance to play around with was Rune Labs, and Rune is essentially an audio playback system, right? So there's a server component that lives on one of the computers in your house, and then you run an application on your, you know, typically on your phone or your tablet, right? And so you know it'll stream to stuff like AirPlay speakers or networked audio players or certain USB DACs and headphone amps. Won a lot of awards in 2015 when it came out. I think like Stereophile's Product of the Year, Computer Audiophile, Digital Audio Review, all gave it big thumbs up. And instead of being something really, really stripped down, I think you guys have heard me talk about Rune Audio and Volumio, both of which you can run on a Raspberry Pi with an external DAC. This is not inexpensive. The pricing for Rune starts at like $120 a year because it comes with all their data service and what they call the Rune Core, which is the software, the server kind of software that manages your audio system. And it integrates Tidal playback into it. Tidal was everywhere. Tidal lossless was everywhere in almost every room. Not every room. There's a lot of vinyl there too, right?
People are using that as their source material to show off their products.
Yeah. If somebody comes in and they want to hear something, if it's on Tidal, they can hear it through that equipment. But for Rune Labs, they either do like $119 a year or $500 for a lifetime membership. You can try it out for $14. But their thing is kind of like, hey, you know, you used to have like big albums, and albums had, you know, liner notes and commentary, and you know what they're doing is making the experience of digging through your music collection, your digital music collection, much, much more visual.
Cool.
So that's what, you know, you're paying for the data service and for the application itself, and it's a really nice way to integrate Tidal in with your existing, hopefully lossless collection of audio. So I've been playing around with that. I'll get to more about
that.
That
is one of the draws for me to still buy music in CD format or disc format is for the some of the cool artwork and designs that go into that packaging. And mm-hmm. Even when I went back through my old disc collection with all those plastic cases
right.
and I was tearing them apart to put them into a folder,
right.
I was amazed at how much hidden stuff I was finding in certain albums. Like, oh, they put a little book of artwork inside of here or something that I had for a decade or whatever and never realized it was in there until right. I actually took the disc apart and or the case apart and that kind of stuff. And so if somebody could put all that with good digital archival mm-hmm. quality and make that super easy for me to just enjoy along with the rest
yeah.
of it.
Well, you're not really using, I don't think, you're not using Rune to create.
No, but if it's just there, so I'm not missing yeah. any of that.
Well, it's also, you know, if you travel out of range, if you don't want to stream lossless audio, if you don't want to, you know, if you don't want to pay for lossless audio, because if you want the best quality from Spotify or Tidal, you're going to pay a monthly fee for it. And of course, if you stop paying for those services, you either downgrade to the crappy quality audio, or you don't have access to that music collection. So that's one of the reasons I keep buying CDs, is because, you know, I have my thousands and thousands and thousands of tracks.
The last disc I bought actually has Braille on it. And I need to translate that, actually. And I just realized
there's something. To find out what it actually says.
There's something you won't be able to do over just an image, though. That's still another reason to get your physical paws on things.
Yeah, well, it's also funny we're talking about streaming audio services because, you know, Spotify and Napster, Spotify and Tidal are still losing money. But Rhapsody International, which owns Napster, actually made a profit for the first time in approximately forever. In this last quarter. But we were talking about audio hardware. Looking at Rune Labs, it's runelabs.com is the website for that one. And I stumbled across that. I wanted to hear Zoo Audio had a ton of speakers there, and Zoo Audio and Peachtree Audio were sharing a room. So Peachtree's integrated amplifiers. And then Zoo Audio provided the speakers for this large conference room kind of area. And part of what Zoo Audio had in there was their crazy experience speakers.
Nice.
See, these are as tall as I am. They're like 5'10", 6
foot tall.
Chocolate
and peanut butter environment, it sounds like.
Well, I took pictures of them because, you know, the
glorious looking.
Press got in like an hour or two before the main show opened. So I got to wander around and listen to people setting stuff up.
Loudspeakers as art.
Yeah. Well, these are Zoo makes really beautiful speakers, and they're in Utah. There's eight or nine people that work at Zoo. Eight of those nine people, including the founder, all work physically building speakers. They Eminence builds some stuff for them. They customize them. They customize the drivers, but they're primarily known for super efficient, like 95, 97, 98 dB efficient speakers. So typically if you're listening to a low power tube amp or you have like a single ended amp, so they're super efficient. But these speakers were crazy. They had 18 inch front firing subwoofers.
That'll rumble the tummy.
Those were the orchestral music on those was pretty impressive. Bass lines were impressive. One of the people on the Audiogon forums had a conversation with Sean from Zoo Audio and said they're probably going to replace that 18-inch front-firing super woofer with a pair of 12-inch side-firing subs.
There you go.
And what's kind of fun about this is one of the reasons you go to an audio show like this or you dig yourself around at CES to get to the smaller rooms where the custom audio setups are because there's speakers there. You know, your local dealer's probably not – okay, here in the Bay Area, there's a couple places where they have – I probably could find a pair of, like, Kef's Blade speakers to listen to in the Bay Area. You probably could do it in New York City. That would be unusual. That's like a $25,000 set of speakers. By the way, props to Kef, who had a room where they had the $25,000 Blade speakers and were, you know, basically they were taking, you know, they've fit every seat in the room. They had like 12 or 15 people in there at a pop, and they would demonstrate stuff on the Blade speakers and then turn around and demonstrate stuff on the LS50s, which sell for $1,500, and they had a show special there for like $1,200. But they also let people like, hey, here's our amazing speakers. Here's these amazing amps we're using. And which actually were produced in San Francisco. I got to remember the name of them. There's some fantastic equipment, which I didn't know anybody was still building even high-end amplifiers in San Francisco. But they were also taking like the same track and playing a digital version of the track versus the track off of vinyl, which I thought was a really cool thing for Kef to do. So
what a cool environment.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things they have, Zoo has less expensive speakers, and they had so they had those big, giant, crazy experienced speakers, and those are going to sell for like $30,000 a pair. And then they had a bunch of Zoos smaller speakers inside of there. I want to say, I think I saw a pair of Souls, Omen Mark IIs maybe. No, Soul Supreme, and I think the Souls were in there. I didn't get to hear a chance. Apparently, in the evenings, they basically fire up a DJ with turntables and play that through the Zoo audio speakers. But, I mean, Zoo's an interesting company. And they also, one of the things that's interesting about Zoo, if people recycle their drivers, as they improve their drivers, they offer Zoo owners the opportunity to recycle or upcycle, I should say, or upgrade their speakers to the newer drivers, and they take those drivers and they repackage them in their what they call the Omen Dirty Weekend speakers. So basically, as they get used drivers in and refurbish them, they put them in new cases and sell those for like a grand a pair.
Nice.
What else did I see? That also got me looking at, because I was talking to Brent Butterworth, and I was like, okay, so Zoo, Klipsch, who else makes, because I have these little 5-watt amps and I want some speakers to drive with them. Tecton actually has some really, really nice, super high efficient speakers, the Mini Lores. Those started about $725 a pair. And this is all primarily stereo music. The Peachtree Audio stuff sounded fantastic. They're not inexpensive. They're Nova 300. It's like 300 watts per channel, but it's got a built-in Saber DAC, a phono stage, home theater bypass. That's like $2,300. They do some really nice gear. And again, this is something where they had Rune Audio running to the Nova and then powering the speakers. So they're very, very
good integration
friendly.
Options.
Yeah, they also have what they call their Deep good Blue variety. 2 Bluetooth music system. And it looks kind of like a Sonos 5, but a little bit bigger. Those sell for about $400 a set. It's pretty badass. It has more bass than any Bluetooth speaker you have heard, but it is also bigger than any Bluetooth speaker you have heard. Deep Blue 2. It's a 440 watt amplifier inside of it, a 6.5 inch woofer, and then 2 3 inch mid range drivers and 2 1 inch soft dome tweeters. And they had a pair of those hooked up in stereo, and that was really, that was rocking the room in no uncertain terms. ELAC was there. I finally bought a pair of the ELAC Unify speakers that I saw at CES. They finally started, the availability loosened up. So I'm getting those broken into my living room. And ELAC was there, and it had a bunch of the stuff. Some stuff I hadn't seen before, and some stuff I had. The stuff I hadn't seen before is they're doing ELAC, who the German sort of the mothership was like, hey, we can't really sell these vinyl-covered speakers. They're great. They sound fantastic. They're $500 a pair. They sound incredible for the money. Can you do something that's painted? So they came up, and by the way, could you make it narrower? Because we need smaller speakers in Europe. So Mr. Jones, the speaker designer, figured out that he could narrow the cabinet, make it a little deeper without changing the sound signature, and then they paint that. So it goes from like $500 for a pair of Unify F5s, to, I want to say $750 for the pair. I should look that up. And then they do, it's like 3 coats of, I guess, hand-rubbed lacquer or whatever they're painting them with, adds to the price.
Glorious. Glorious paintwork. Often does. Be it any
yeah.
good object.
So they were showing those off in black and white. Where is it? There it is. So it's $500 a pair for the regular vinyl coated ones, and for the narrower painted ones is $750 a pair. So that's a pretty healthy VIG. Listening to those in that hotel room, I'm like, okay, I'm buying these speakers. These are the speakers I'm going to put in my living room for right now.
Nice. But
they also had something I'm playing
that's
around
good.
With.
So
right
even with
now.
The compact design, you were thoroughly satisfied.
Yeah.
And the
they
ears,
had the towers there. They had the smaller ones there. And, well, it's interesting, right? Because they do the sound signature is extremely similar between their bookshelf speaker and their tower speaker. But the tower speaker's got 2 additional woofers in the. It's a much taller enclosure.
Right.
And then they put an extra pair of woofers inside of those, or I should say they're a pair of 4-inch mid-range drivers. So they go down to about 40 hertz, and you basically get more impact at the low end with the towers, but it's essentially the same sound signature.
I like usually what that kind of setup does for voices, too.
Yeah.
Gives a little extra rumble when needed.
Nothing wrong with that.
Gravel.
They have their integrated amplifier on display, which are, and what's really cool about that is – they have what they call their ABC technology. So there's an app that sits on your phone, and it will tune the crossover point for the subwoofer and can tune using the DSPs on board the integrated amplifier. So it can kind of tune what's coming out of the amplifier to behave well with your room, to, you know, match the crossover on the subwoofer. You know, you can use the application to change the inputs, to change the labels on the inputs, which is something like, you know, my now 7-year-old probably AV receiver. Like, I would kill to be able to change the input names on my AV receiver.
That's one thing I have appreciated about Yamaha amps, is at least for a long time, their AV app that you use with their amps, it gives you all of that customization right within the app itself. Compared to trying to do it within just using the controls on the physical AV receiver itself, that's a little kludgy and kind of painful. But
yeah, emotionally traumatic. Maybe
it's,
not emotionally traumatic,
but a pain.
It's much nicer to just
type on a keyboard on your damn smartphone or something to change out and customize to your delight. Basically.
Yeah, it was interesting. So they that integrated amplifier that ELAC's making, it's just about to go on sale. The EA101 EQ-G. It's 85 watts per channel into 4-ohm or 8-ohm speakers. They're using a Bash amplifier, so Class D amplifier, a switching amplifier. So the idea is that, I should say, it's funny. It's a switched mode power supply, quote, allied to a conventional Class AB amplifier. So the idea is to get you the, you know, typical, you know, audiophile amplifier these days is probably Class AB. And then they're using a you know, sort of a Class D power switching power supply to get it all of the power it needs, but still not sort of use all of the power it can suck out of the wall, which is probably the worst description ever. Sounded fantastic.
I think I get it.
And, you know, the iOS and Android app looked really, really cool. You know, you can create master volumes. You can tweak the individual, you know, input. I would say you can tweak the input volumes. It was interesting also that auto blend to watch that in action. And the ELAC app can actually, you know, teach its controls to your IR remote control. So that was pretty slick. What else did I see? I love the entry-level rooms at Rocky Mountain Audio Fest, where they essentially had, like, you know, you've got $100, you've got $500, you've got $1,500. You know, here's what you can do with that. Who else did I see? The Kef room, you know, hearing the Kef blades was really, really cool. Hearing them go back and forth between the Kef blades and the LS50s was really cool. Focal was there. There was a great headphone panel with the principals from Focal, PSB, Hi-Fi Man, Tile from InnerFidelity.com, Jude from head-fi.com, all talking about the future of headphones and what they see coming.
Cool.
And the founder of Mr. Speakers was there too. That was really, really cool. I mentioned the iSigns from Odyssey.
Definitely, you know, a good panel of respectable industry folk who can have a moment just to bounce subject matter off each other in a quick, you know, QA style environment. Those are done right, they can be just such a great little interaction to watch. And
a lot of what they were talking about was kind of like what they see coming in terms of, you know, the surround sound stuff, the VR stuff being brought to headphones. I got to listen to a little more extended time to listen to the Ether and the Ether C and the Ether Flow and the Ether C Flow, which is the Mr. Speakers stuff. They started out modding like Fostexes, and then they built their own planar magnetics. And it was interesting hearing the story from the founder about how his experiences in examining audio gear changed what they were producing. I'll talk about this, you know, more at another time, but it was really cool.
That sounds awesome.
I could go on for a while. I don't want to put everybody to sleep. But who else was there? Astell and Kern was there. I got to listen to some, you know, I was listening to their AK Junior for a while. They have a new Bluetooth receiver.
Was there anything at this show that you saw in an early enough state or in a state that where people were telling you, come back, come see us at CES or something like that?
No, pretty much everything everybody had. There was one thing that I got to hear that actually I have in now for testing. Rupert Neve Designs. Rupert Neve is the console designer that was made famous. Rupert Neve has been building mixing consoles forever. And one of the most famous ones is the console that was in, I want to say, Sound City. And gosh, where is it? Sound City Studios in Los Angeles, California. Van Nuys, Los Angeles, California. And they had, basically Dave Grohl, who you might know from Nirvana and the Foo Fighters, purchased the Neve 8028 console from Sound City Studio A and did this huge documentary about it, because this console had produced an extraordinary, along with the Foo Fighters and Nirvana and Rage Against the Machine's first album, Neil Young, Dr. John, Spirit, Crazy Horse, Leon Russell, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
A particular console.
This particular console. Ronnie James Dio, Foreigner, the Black Crowes.
I see the attraction.
This nexus, like this incredible, you just read these albums, this listed Rick Springfield, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, System of a Down, Death Cab for Cutie, Wolf Mother, Kid Rock, Metallica did at least one album there, Rycooter. It just goes on and on. So Rupert Neve's been designing legendary consoles or legendary professional production equipment for approximately forever, 40, 50 years. He came out with a headphone amplifier, the RNHP Precision headphone amplifier. And a friend of mine who tests headphones, his sort of like institutional grade, his what I'll affectionately call his medical grade headphone amplifier he uses for headphone testing, was on the Fritz, and he borrowed, he had this RNHP Precision headphone amplifier, this Rupert Neve headphone amplifier, and he was like, it's ridiculous, because it was even cleaner than his, sort of...
His super box.
Not cheap, about $500, but it'll probably drive a freight train if it's attached to your head. What else? I got to hear AudioQuest's new closed-backed Night Owl headphones. I have those in for testing. I'll talk about those in the next week or two. Those are doing out of carbon fiber, and they're doing the Nighthawk Carbon, which is the update to the Nighthawks I talked about that are coming out. What else? Man, so many things. So I'm going to stop talking about that there. Well,
That's the beauty of a show like that, though. Rocky Mountain Audio Fest is that... It's more than one person can take in, yet... Man, it gives you the opportunity just in a very short period of time to see a lot.
Yeah, I mean...
And the best from every company you can think of.
It was crazy.
Hopefully.
I mean, I walked into PS Audio, who a lot of people have seen.
And it's Denver.
Yeah, which is always nice. I got to see my cousin-in-law.
Better
for
and better
a few
every
minutes.
Time I go there.
Yeah, it was crazy because like PS Audio, a lot of people know them for the Sprout, which is a $500 integrated amplifier. They had their sort of big, their primary run of amplifiers probably cost more than I paid for every car I own combined. I didn't even bother to find out. I should have asked the name of the speakers they were connected to, but I stopped counting at like 36 drivers in this crazy. There was like two 10-foot high towers of tweeters and like 2 6-foot boxes full of subwoofers. It's cool because you get to hear this stuff that is if you have all of the money, Macintosh was there.
And then you see setups like that. And then it's also stuff like the interconnects and things like that that I also get interested in. It's like, who did you just, or what did you decide to use to table all this together?
Yeah, it's like $11,000 worth of copper. this is not my normal, $500 speakers that sound like $1,500 speakers. That's generally my jam.
We secretly replaced all of these high-end cables with 12-gauge
zip wire.
Monoprice four-wire cable.
It
sounded great.
It was good. Biodynamics was there. I heard the DT1770 Pro. Those sound really, really good. There's a lot of really good-sounding stuff. I don't think I heard anything bad except for,
anything explode or smoke or
nothing exploded, nothing smoked. One of the things that was interesting is they were really pushing... a lot of the vendors there would have a particular time and where they would like play an entire album.
Chill out hour.
A chill out hour, yeah. Or they were doing sort of listening sessions.
Golden Ear folks like in the middle of one of those demos start screaming out that it's just too loud and you're going to damage my hearing? And
No, it was actually all pretty reasonable volume.
Oh, some of the craziest, I mean, the eyeball people are kind of nuts in their own way, but the ear people, I find, as far as your listeners.
I'm pretty sensitive to high volumes.
I don't want my hearing damage, but I've also had people be very strict about it.
I love being in Dolby's theater.
I'm going to walk out of this room.
But Dolby's theater, like, they're always running it at like 100. It seems like they're running it at 100 dB plus all the time, which is pretty brutal. Thoris.com. I'd never heard of them before. They do tube amplifiers and loudspeakers. And they were one of the places, they were doing like a complete set of one of XTC's albums. And it was really crazy because all of their equipment, they had their 845 power amplifiers, you know, and these speakers they sell, I think they sell for like, you know, $18,000 a pair, their loudspeaker too. You know, that they have like, you know, a super tweeter firing vertically and a big wide band, like a wide band horn and a 12-inch woofer inside of this 100 dB efficient speaker.
Experiments in driving.
And it was, well, part of what was so cool is
pretty awesome.
I wanted to get pictures because all of their equipment looks like it was built. It looked like electronics lab equipment from the 50s.
That's all right.
And it was just utterly gorgeous. And it's so much of this equipment at this end is about the visual appearance so much as it is, you know, the actual, the visual appearance. It was just, you know,
look,
if you're going to spend $20,000 for a couple of amps, they better really look nice, I think is part of the theory there.
Generally not hiding that behind acoustically transparent cloth or burying them in a wall.
Well, you hide it behind acoustically transparent cloth if you have children in the house, but that's a whole other conversation.
Oh.
Dude, so you went to China.
I did.
You went to Hisense's factory.
I did.
What was that like?
That was cool. They invited me over to take a look at how they do what they do and their recent, relatively, acquisition of the Sharp brand name for the next 5 or so years. They're going to be bringing out TVs. They're currently the manufacturer for those TVs. So if you're buying a Sharp TV today, boom, you'd be buying something actually put together by the folks at Hisense. They are a big company. They are one of the big companies in China. They're like the number one for appliances and things like that. So if you've lived in China all your life, you'll see their air conditioners as common as anything in terms of, you know, the most obvious things to look at. I will also say solar water heaters on the rooftop, the thermal solar.
Yeah,
incredibly popular everywhere you go, and just one minor observation. But within the country of China, though, Hisense controls has over 70% of the market as far as traffic automation goes.
Oh,
so this is the company that makes all the cameras, which they, as far as Chinese driving and traffic goes, they've really tried to automate as much as possible, including ticketing your butt for being in the wrong lane or doing the things you shouldn't be doing. In addition to being able to help find the quote-unquote bad guys, and I'll kind of leave that at that. But we had a big demonstration about just the traffic control stuff, and that was everything from like, oh, we have a sensor system where basically if a person steps off the sidewalk, we can then detect it, look at it, see if we need to adjust timing on other things around there because this person's doing something they shouldn't have, or an unexpected event and things like that. And just in terms of how you keep traffic flowing in a ever-growing population in cities and everything like that. The first part of the trip I spent up in Qingdao, not north, but northern part of the country, right along the coastline. Beautiful old fishing village, 100 years ago, early settled by the Germans who gratefully brought all that beer. And so beer is a huge part of not only that region, and there is actually a dedicated park, like Disneyland-sized park, dedicated to this yearly beer festival in August, which I would recommend going back. They just built they gutted the old park and built a brand new park that was about to kick in for this for the season that just kicked in. Anyway, that was gorgeous. Spent a day at their research and development facility, which I have been to places like, say, DreamWorks down in L.A. with their campus, and it is as much of a villa and a glorious place to walk around as any place I've been in work-wise. And this research and development facility for Hisense in Qingdao was very similar in terms of picturesque location, right in the kind of a mountainous tree country. But just in terms of the layout within internally, it was very campus-like. Very interactive in terms of you could see different departments and things going on and kind of very obvious where everything was and just very inviting and just visually fun just to walk around and check out everything from folks doing the day-to-day grind for running a business like that to their engineers working on new displays and, you know, everything from board designs to assembly techniques to, you know, it got into it pretty deeply. And eventually we also made our way over to where they actually assembled the panels themselves over to another facility.
Did you get to see the panels being made?
Interestingly enough, Hisense does not actually manufacture an LCD panel.
Really?
They actually source them from other manufacturers within the region. And there are some benefits to that, given that the cost of owning one of these plants, generally, it's tough to make money. Let me just put it that way. So it's better to then buy somebody who's rolling with the tech you need as far as just the LCD panel goes. And then you can work on all of the other back-end electronic stuff, everything from, you know, power supplies, CPUs, and everything on up. And that includes even backlighting systems and, you know, chassis design and every other aspect of it. And in terms of bringing all those parts together and making them work, that was something Hisense really focused on. It was the how they want to be able to do this yet make a quality product. And one of the things I have never seen at any other manufacturer's facilities that they actually allowed us to walk in and look at was their destructive testing.
Oh, wow.
And I was looking at a whole bunch of LCD panels being put into the worst conditions you could possibly imagine, including rooms I walked into where I'm like, this is incredibly uncomfortable to be standing in this room right now.
Oh, really?
It was like they had these special temperature and humidity rooms set up so they can contain it, confine it, and measure, you know. Here, we put in a dozen of them. Let's see how they fail, if they fail, and if they all do it in a certain way. Maybe there's a tweak we can do to make it better so it doesn't fail like that. But it was like rooms of 130 degrees with 70% humidity, a room that would cycle the display back and forth between like practically freezing to that same crazy humidity and temperature, and being able to cycle that over and over. And I've seen those machines from a distance, but that was the first time I actually got to open up the doors and walk inside and see
some very sympathetic,
very stressed LCDs, if nothing else, and a very enthusiastic group of engineers too who work on this kind of stuff. And a lot of I've worked in manufacturing back in my college days, and the workforce in general are the bottom jobs you get entry level into are look like a lot of college age kids doing basic assembly and things like that. But you can move your way up, and 6-day work weeks generally for most folks. They provide a lot of free housing if you want it, local. Things like trips, and because of the scale of the country and how many people you deal with, even getting like major holidays at an airport or like can be a pain in the ass just to even schedule a vacation. So the company tends to do a lot for their employees on those kind of levels in terms to make family life
That's
and things
cool.
a little more doable. And also too, within the testing and analysis side of it, I will say they had all of the tools I could possibly ask for doing everything for subjective analysis, where you're looking at content on a screen of a tuned or just built TV, to very objective testing with the best equipment you could ask for, in addition to folks who knew everything about worldwide signal formats and how things should need to work for a particular region or country. And being able to do that back and forth, like, okay, the nerds will build the display and it should be effectively perfect with the signals you put into it. Yet we'll move that over to the subjective side where we actually connect these devices and double, triple check things like that. I had an opportunity to walk into RF testing facilities where basically it's a room. I've been in similar rooms, but basically you have a very RF dead room with a platform and special tiles all over the place, 360 with usually a rotating platform in the middle and an antenna array that points at the device and it's rotated and you measure what comes off of it for doing, you know, make sure you're not leaking something you shouldn't be, or so to speak. But I will say it was also my first opportunity to go into an anechoic chamber, which I had never been in either.
Oh, it's unpleasant.
At first, it is wrong in terms of the sound quality of the room. It is so dead.
I always feel like
there is no reflection of any audio. And as you move further into the center of this room, and you're on a grill, there's probably like 10 feet of geometry, foam objects below you. There is just very dense or very deep walls to capture very low frequencies in addition to the high frequency stuff. So by the time you got to the center of this room, it is so quiet. It's almost like
it
would even be fun to sleep in or take a nap in. At first I made that joke, but then I sat there for a few minutes and it's like, whatever sounds you're internally making, like your blood pressure or going through your arteries and stuff, starts to become apparent. And it's like, okay, I need a little background sound or something, a little ocean noise or something. Anyway, that was super cool. And display-wise, one of the highlights of the show or of the tours was looking at a new laser 4K projector they have coming out.
Really?
And they're shooting for a $10,000 price point, probably 12 in retail, 10 as it really gets into the marketplace.
That would be significantly less expensive than what we've seen.
Short throw design, so you can keep it very close to the wall. The cool part about it, really, one, it's DLP, which was kind of interesting. 4K DLP, single chip.
With a laser?
With a laser, short throw. So it's either, I want to say it was a full resolution chip. Actually, I take that back. It's probably half resolution 4K, and then they're doing twin. Each mirror on the DLP chip from Texas Instruments probably is driving two separate pixels in addition to the off state. But the screen was really the key to making this work. And I saw this projector demonstrated in a variety of room lighting conditions, from well-controlled up to I would not put a projector in this room. And yet it always seemed to work really well, simply because this was a light-rejecting screen they were using, in the sense that you could almost think of the Surface having a louvered structure system where the light that's it's a directional screen, in a sense, where it knows the light should be. It's optimized for light coming up from the bottom, hitting that screen surface and pretty much rejecting any light that's coming down from the top, like at light sources up above you, like in the ceiling or whatever. And it got enough of that light back in you, even in a well-lit room, to be totally useful. We were demonstrating on like about 108-inch screen, say, with the projector sitting right there. And it worked really, really well. And for 4K resolution at that price point at 100-plus inches, that's a freaking bargain. And I'll be really curious to see what sort of picture performance. I had no opportunity to actually put any testing or measurement tools on it.
How much do you think they're going to sell it for?
It should be here in the U.S. by the end of the year at about $10,000.
Okay.
Right about in that price point. And I imagine as soon as their 4K stuff starts rolling in that single chip design, you'll start to see some other stuff too. But
interesting.
Overall, the company's goal was really to bring a desirable TV with that manufacturing quality expertise that they seem to have, and they demonstrated over and over again, to the North American markets. And they know they're Hisense isn't like a name brand yet, and they want to make it so. And I think they're going to use that Sharp brand name as kind of like, oh, you might be familiar with that brand, but if everything flows the way I saw in terms of their research, development, testing, everything looked good, and they are certainly capable of producing a good TV. And I can't wait to check out some of their upcoming products. Their H8 is out now, and I'll be getting one of those in, of course, for testing. But they have an H10 that everyone's kind of looking at as their first full array local dimming, you know, HDR, super bright, with the wide color palette.
Their kind of first flagship. And Hisense was one of, along with TCL, were the two companies that were really pushing bringing Roku TV integrated into the televisions before anybody else.
I absolutely love it. And then they weren't even going to show us this one room, but then thank goodness some of the handlers with us were like, you know, this is the kind of stuff they really want to see. But it was all a bunch of like prototype style TVs and whatnot. And they had some throwback designs with an actual knob on the front. A very, very nice like spin knob, like you'd have like AV receiver style quality. But I'm like, you know, that looks, or with like pseudo wood frame finishes and things like that. And I'm like, you know, if you just keep the cost normal, that to me is as appealing, at least in one room of the house, as any of the other, you know, silver, black, blah, blah, blah framed TVs, even with the minimal bezels we have nowadays. But there's some really clever designs there too. And in addition to their, of course, appliance division, which we saw lots of, and their mobile, actually had a tour of their mobile device assembly facility as well, where they were putting screens, watching cell phones be born, basically. And I am shocked at the amount of handwork that goes into it in terms of QA testing.
Oh, really?
Oh, there's also, you also realize too, for any given job in that country, China and the U.S. are about the same size as far as landmass goes. It's like 9.3 so many units to 9.1 so many units. It's pretty similar, but there's four times as many people, at least, or more. And so there's a lot of jobs that, while they could be automated, it's still cost effective just to have somebody do it or to teach them how to do it. And And one thing I saw over and over again within this style of manufacturing, where you have assembly and stages and lines of people interacting, were some of the custom tooling that goes in, where it's like, oh, you know what? We could create this tool that helps automate this one particular step. We'll hand and build it in-house. We have a room full of engineers who can probably figure this out. So you see a lot of custom stuff people get really proud about. It's like, hey, we actually built this to make this so much easier for our workers and improve, you know, efficiency and quality and blah, blah, blah. But just watching like a phone be built for a certain market, even in terms of, oh, it has these radios in it programmed this way and this interface. And
were the assembly lines huge? Were these like massive, you know, 7 Walmart kind of store size,
Costco size facilities? And they could vary because it depended on, you know, how many of that particular thing they were doing that month or week and broken down. But generally, 15,000 square meter facilities for certain spots of doing things, and usually multi-level. So you had like, once it's packaged, it goes upstairs for final boxing and blah, blah, blah. And then the end finished box comes out the end.
So when you saw people walking around, because you walked around Hong Kong, you walked around Kowloon,
did my time in Qingdao, which is up north a little bit, I jumped on the plane and I was done with Hisense and the wonderful area up there. By the way, it's amazing seafood. Uh-huh. You're in an amazing mountainous area that has like the most pristine waters and coastal areas of the whole country. It's gorgeous up there as everywhere. But then jumped on the plane, flew through Nantong to Shenzhen. Uh-huh. And then spent some time in Shenzhen, which is just above, it's right on the border above Hong Kong and Kowloon. And so then Shenzhen is like a great tech city. And that day I landed, there was a big convention going on with a bunch of nerds running around doing their thing it's a great trade show that happened to be going on right when I got there. I kind of skipped that just to take in more of the city and have a good time right there, because one benefit of being in Shenzhen is that it has a wonderful train station that hooks up with long distance trains to anywhere in the country within China, and then also the local muni, and it's a border control station as well. So I literally could walk out of my hotel, take muni to that station, cross the border into literally Hong Kong or outside of China going south, jump on a muni train right there, and within an hour be in Kowloon, continue taking muni right into Hong Kong if you want. Especially Hong Kong, I will say, just the overall the ability to get around, how easy it is, everything from internet access being, as far as I could tell, unrestricted compared to China.
Sure.
Which is one of the aspects of traveling in China you come to a realization of, is that
a lot of paperwork.
That or it just there's a lot of things blocked. Facebook, Twitter, most Google services in mainland China. So everyone who needs to do that uses a VPN service of some kind. And it was interesting.
You ran a VPN pretty much the whole time you were there.
Just especially in China, if you need to use Google services, just because it's lacking. And let alone the maps within mainland China that you do have access to through Google are pretty limited compared to like services from, say, like Bing or OpenStreetMaps. And again, once you kind of got out of there and went to Hong Kong or crossed the border out of there, it all kind of opens back up. And it's really night and day in terms of just the internet side of it. But I will say, just as soon as you cross that border, though, into Hong Kong, there's like a single transit system that can be all used with one prepaid card. You just kind of load up with cash. And that card could actually be used anywhere as well, for local shops, restaurants. It just made getting around. You could jump on a bus or the ferry, take the ferry across to Hong Kong, all with a single card. That just made day-to-day simple. Air-conditioned, fully heated train systems and everything. Everything's on time, made to move people efficiently. It was awesome.
Was pretty much, you know, as you went from sort of an industrial city, you know, sort of a manufacturing city to an industrial center, international industrial center to Hong Kong, where people like, you know, here in the United States, where basically everywhere you go, their face is buried in a cell phone and they're, you know, they're texting or you know,
there's
WhatsApping or Facebooking or Snapchatting.
Always.
Or watching video.
It's a program called WeChat in Asia that does, it's the everything app in terms of, it would be the Facebook, SMS, you can order food, pay rent. And everything through this one app, and it's pretty damn useful. So, yeah, there is a lot of that, but at the same time, I found it to be indistinguishable for the most part.
Sure.
As for what I see here in California and elsewhere in the United States, in terms of, yeah, there's a lot of people with their faces looking at the phone. But at the same point, man, people put their phones away and look around and do all the normal stuff. Mm-hmm. That part really wasn't very different at all. I will say it is a very small world after all. And Google Translate was a godsend for me, at least in terms of just being able to have one app as a U.S. user to be able just to – I preloaded it with, you know, local translations and things like that. But I had everything from regular conversations with someone just sitting there and it doing real-time voice to be able to hold up the thing to a sign and says, oh, that says it's a rocky shoreline with rogue waves and I should probably take a few steps back. And it's like, okay, thank you. Thank you for the translation. And
that's really great. So you're on your phone over a VPN to Google servers in the United States doing a real-time conversation with translation?
Usually,
and you didn't get slapped.
Usually when you need the speed more than you don't, that's when it fails you. So, but when it worked, it was fantastic. And
that's crazy. And awesome.
And there is some preloaded stuff you can have on the phone, but it always seemed to not work. Like you can download offline translation stuff, but for whatever reason, it never seemed to work right when I needed it. So it always, but it always worked when I was connected to the internet and border control and things like that. It'd been a while since I've used a passport, so it was. It takes once or twice before you finally realize, yeah, get those arrival departure docs filled out before you get in line. And it'll make life much easier. And I owe a big shout out to, I think, a border control agent in just going across into China where I got held up for about 20 minutes, where they spent an awful long time looking at my passport before finally coming back to me and saying there was something wrong with the chip in it. And I'm like, nobody had said anything about that up until this point. And I'm like, why is this taking so long? And then I'm like, she just points at the chip on it. She says, there's something probably funky with that chip. And I'm like, well, I think I microwaved the damn thing at some point, but right when I first got it, because I was back in the, anyway, very likely there may have been something wrong with it. But then I was like, oh, but I gave my departure doc to the guy and it was the one I was supposed to use a couple days later. She just says, here, they're all the same. Hands me a stack of like 50 of them.
Oh,
like,
funny.
Just fill them out as you need them. I'm like, oh. Oh, and then it's like from that point forward, I was just like, you know what? As long as you're just trying to get from A to B, everyone wants to help you. And I will say in every train station, in every border place or every place, there was always somebody in a brightly colored shirt waiting with usually a small megaphone on their hip just to help direct traffic and things like that. And generally speaking, every country I've been in outside of the United States for international travel, you have things in multiple languages. It's generally spelled out really clearly. I mean, man, if you speak some language, chances are you'll be able to look up and figure out where to walk or where to go next. And when I came back into the U.S. and specifically to San Francisco International, it just felt like the most unwelcoming message. There was like no welcome to California, let alone San Francisco. It felt like you're walking down a high secure area complete with a blast door I had to walk through, which was kind of new. But then just the signage in general, it is ridiculously scant and non-existent. Minor complaint, but every airport you're going to walk into in the world that I've been in gives you free luggage carts to help move your ass in and out of there. please take a free cart and get out. When you go to any airport in the United States, they're all paid for.
You have to pay for
it. Yeah, or you have to lease it or whatever. And a lot of people don't know that or whatever. So thankfully, some of the airlines will just buy a bunch of those carts and have them waiting for you. Because otherwise, you're like, wait, you don't want me to leave easier? Or anyway. But San Francisco needs some help with that international wing, especially in terms of just if I were that like my first visit,
right?
I go, this is about as cold and uninviting as it gets, man. I'm not saying it's got to be flowers and, you know, the smell of the Shangri-La Hotel wafting through as I come through the gate of the airport or whatever, but just some digital signs, at least, within multiple languages to make it stupid obvious for you know, I came running in. It's like, yeah, I can read that tiny little plaque up on the wall that's written in English, and I'm banging right through this. This is awesome. I'm usually on the other end where it's like, man, I hope I'm in the right line. And, oh, I just hope I got all my paperwork filled out right. It's like, please let this go smoothly. And
Oh, that's funny, dude.
Construction. If there's one overriding theme to everywhere I went,
in the whole region is freaking construction. It's just the scale and the amount, and it's happening everywhere.
Really?
Just renovation, cities, you know, tearing down the older stuff and putting up the new stuff. In that fishing village community of Qingdao, right, that's, you know, 100 years old plus, there are some holdouts along that you'd be driving along, and it's like, man, this is like brand new everything, and all of a sudden, ramshackle house on the side of the road that just like, what the hell is this still doing here? Right across from like some brand new mall or something. And they're like, oh yeah, those are usually locals who've been here forever, and they usually just want a floor of one of the new apartment buildings. So, but then it's like, if you ever do see that, just don't assume, oh, it's the haves and the have-nots. Well, there is a lot of that as well. But in those particular circumstances, it's usually somebody trying to hold out for a really good deal. And they will probably get it. But electrification of the country in general. Man, I saw Teslas there. Like at a rate, I see Teslas here. And in terms of city life, everyone has an electric scooter. I saw very few gas-powered scooters anywhere I went, which was super cool. Plug-in scooters. Coolest one I saw was a dude had not only the folding bike, but it was the folding electric scooter. And he came off of a muni bus, plopped the thing down, unfolded it right on the sidewalk, and just zipped away silently. And that was very popular. And again, the muni and the train and bus systems were absolutely fantastic. Outside of mainland China, for food and entertainment, you know, people sometimes use Yelp and apps like that to find local things. There's one called Open Rice, which is just the most brutal thing ever in terms of what is good that day. What is everyone's favorite thing in this city or in this area? And you're able to whip this open and say, all right, just what's happening right now? What's like the best place to eat? Within either 100 meters of me or within, you know, like the city tonight, like where's everyone's favorite spot now? And it was like, for that, super awesome. And then otherwise, I'm just thankful too that just about everything we travel with gear wise nowadays, switching power supplies, good from like 100 volts up to 240. Uh-huh. So that will, as long as you're carrying gear like that and USB powered stuff, power conversions everywhere I went, I had one adapter, which I absolutely love. In terms of gear, which will just basically convert any power plug type in the world pretty much into any other power plug type. And it's just a little cube thing I carried around. But that was effectively the only thing I needed. And I brought like a travel power strip with me and stuff. Just, you know, thinking I'd need more outlets and things. But
this thing's pretty crazy.
I've had kits that include a lot of adapters. But this is like all those stupid adapters for all the plug types in the world. This just puts it all in one little block that with two USB power ports.
So we have USA, UK, Australia, China. I'm not sure where that one's for. And then it's got iOS and Android plugs.
Yeah, the USB ones.
USB plugs.
And those are putting out at least 2,400 milliamp whatevers. So they weren't like, you know, it's not like very low charging capability. But yeah, so for in the case of Hong Kong, they were, you know, settled by the British forever, so guess what, they have the UK style power plugs everywhere,
the flat ones.
So I was using that,
and then the European, the two pins.
Yep,
very cool.
And then for any time I was in the mainland, it was mostly the slanted style that's also used in
I really
Australia.
Like that it has a fuse and a spare fuse.
Yeah,
built into the controller.
I gotta tell you, man, that even when I would like drop my bag and travel light, I carried that around with me just in case. But the other big thing I think everyone should own when they're traveling anywhere nowadays is our
USB.
Your lithium ion power packs. Those are indispensable, man.
I usually have at least 15,000 milliamp hour. I usually have one 15,000 milliamp hour battery and a second 12,000 milliamp hour.
That's a good battery. Those are good sizes to have. You will need one per person per day minimum, because I ended up using my phone for everything. Pictures, video, location. Jeez, Pokemon Go. Pokemon Go in Hong Kong, in the financial district of Hong Kong, is just a crazy playland. You can run around. You should be looking at the sights and scenes and amazing architecture. And
but you're running around chasing. You're like Shannon.
I took a few moments
Pokemon.
Just to at least grab a Starbucks coffee. Okay. The funniest things of all, just general observations. McDonald's is the corner restaurant of most of China.
Really?
The 24-hour joint, like a Denny's you could run into and get something at any hour. And they're everywhere. But I think the most popular chain restaurant in all everywhere I went was Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Really?
Unbelievably popular, man. It's just, I mean, granted, there's some localized menu items, of course, and there's everyone, you know, certain breakfast items and things people want, but as far as, but otherwise, you know, I didn't set foot in either one of those places while I was there.
Best meal you had while you were there?
Oh, man. In Qingdao, we went to a seafood joint that was kind of known for this family-style dining, and they would bring out these plates or these trays of freshly caught, steamed with the family recipe, but it was like a combination of, like, of crab, crazy mushroom things. It also had shrimps and scallops and all kinds of mussels and clams. And you just, the serves, I mean, we had smalls and then we had probably 6-8 people at each table and the small was plenty, but everyone just dove into this thing. And that was some of the best seafood I've ever had anywhere. I would say the quality of produce, including fruits and vegetables and nuts and let alone the fishing and everything. It's just, it's, I didn't see anybody hungry anywhere, and you can get a cheap meal anywhere. Like using that Open Rice app, I was like, what's within 100 meters of me? And it's like some hole in the wall that I would have never walked into otherwise. And I am clearly the only, you know, let alone American, but just a blonde haired, blue eyed dude walking in. I'm the freak anywhere I walk.
So you're tall. Like, so.
Yeah. Actually, there's a lot of tall Asian people. I was not the shortest. Anyway, but being able to walk into a restaurant like that and just, you know, dumplings of any kind or some, you know, rice noodle soup or whatever. Vegetables are probably the most popular thing, but just food-wise, it's a fantastic voyage. You just are constantly trying out either street food or restaurants or you name it. Best meal I had, honestly, one of the first nights I got there, I just walked out of the hotel and said, forget it, I'm just going to go get lost. And so I'm walking down the street, and this couple was setting up like literally a little roll-up door where they had like a refrigerated area, small, real tiny, but they moved everything out onto the sidewalk to do the cooking and everything else. And you could have any kind of like ramen-style soup made right there, custom. And I didn't speak any of the language. All I could do was smell. It was just delicious. And when she came over, it was
he has what? Pokemon from mainland China on his phone. Shannon just
well, not mainland China. It's a vast wasteland there as far as Pokemon go.
But so no Pokemon Kong, in mainland China, but Hong Kong.
Yeah, you move across the border, and it explodes into gloriousness.
Sorry about that. yeah, but we can wrap up because you want to start recording. Yeah. Give us 2 minutes. We'll wrap it up.
I'm sorry.
I was like listening to my audio.
And I was like, "That's
probably." Sorry about that, Mr. Loud. Yeah, we'll finish up. So I walked past this couple shop, and the smell smelled like every best bowl of soup I ever had. It's just there's a certain smell, and you're like, okay, whatever that is, it's good. And
I want that.
The first night I walked by, it was incredibly busy, and I was just like, okay, this is nuts. Thank goodness again for Google Translate, and for me just being able to point and smile and be cool about everything, because I was like, I just want this. And it's like, okay, usually people would just go to the fridge, pick out the ingredients you want, and hand them to the chef. She or he would do it up and hand it to you and serve it to you right there, or give it to you to go, or however you wanted it. But I'm like, I don't know exactly what everything is in the fridge, and I would rather you just kind of make one up. And I'll eat anything. So I was just like, I go, if I have to tell you some ingredients, I'm like, okay, vegetables, chicken. It doesn't really matter. It's like I'll eat meat of, you know, just go. I'll look delicious. So this was like the sweetest couple with the simplest shop, and for like $3, man, I had the most, less than $3, I had like the most amazing bowl of soup that filled me up, and I just sat there sweating my brains out on the side. She kind of came over last and was like, how spicy do you want it? I got the message. She was showing me stuff in the bowl. I'm like, oh, that looks all spicy. It's like, do you want a lot or a little? Or I'm like, a little. Yeah, make it a little spicy. But it was just perfect. And I vowed that that would be my last meal when I was there as well, because it was just, the flavor was so good. But it was great, man. And you figure, too, because of the weather and everything, with the heat opening up at 6 p.m. at night, catching that crowd, which in that area, it was a lot of working class folk and pretty mellow, generally speaking, in the neighborhood I was in. There was also, like, anywhere you walk, there's going to be a street of barbers, a street of tailors, and things like that. And then then you have sections of different ethnicities for those types of tailors and,
oh, wow.
And different clans too. So especially when you get into Hong Kong, it was like all ethnicities and types, and
so it was very neighborhoody.
Yes, but with lots of integration and lots of like. The best times I had were simply like, I'm going to get off my train two stops early and just go up to this top street level and see what's there. It was like, oh my goodness, this crazy shopping zone, or where it's like everyone sits up their stalls and it's just super mellow, but you can like.
So you got your board to eat on.
I had a lot of that, man. I really was just a wanderer. And being able to just mix some great work experience with just traveling around and playing tourist. And actually, you know, setting up some flights while I was there and riding along with a lot of the other folks who were just, you know, working and living in the country was priceless as far as I could tell. I just, I really enjoyed my time there. And
it sounds amazing.
I highly recommend anybody do it. And please, we got to really do something about the uninviting nature of our U.S. airports. Quit making it look like a freaking prison. And man, there should be free Wi-Fi everywhere you walk. That's the other thing too.
The problem with free Wi-Fi in airports is it's usually ripe for pwnage by nefarious.
Yeah, there's got to be an easy way to do it. So
probably.
Yeah, I can't recommend. Nice thing about Hong Kong and Kowloon and that whole part of the world, anybody with a U.S. passport can show up and you get a 90-day visa. I think it's 90.
Oh, wow.
I ended up, for mainland China, you have to apply for a visa there. And then they ended up giving me one good for 10 years that's good for 60 days at a time. So as long as you have your visa set up, man, as soon as you get to a place, it becomes very easy to travel around within that country. I found a couple sites that are perfect for traveling around in that kind of world in terms of setting up hotel rooms or for setting up travel. And I'll throw those in our show notes. But one called Agoda.com, A-G-O-D-A, for hotels, and one called Q-U-A.com for flights. And between those two, you can do that part of the world cheaply in terms of getting around and finding great places to stay. And definitely more English speakers in Hong Kong in that area and part of the world.
That makes sense.
It does. And when you get to Hong Kong itself, specifically around the business district, that's as crazy as anything I've seen anywhere in the world in terms of architecture and design and just the visuals. It's like a Manhattan with the beautiful hills right there with amazing just homes and businesses and whatnot. And
so it's good times.
Very open. Yeah. Very safe. Very air quality. Okay. Last thing I'll talk about. Generally air quality when you're along the coastlines is going to be great or decent. There's a website, I think it's AQI, let me just see here, Air Quality Index, AQICN.org, and I would definitely take a look at that before you decide to travel anywhere if you have any kind of breathing problems whatsoever. Beijing in particular, day I landed, not so bad, moderate pollution. The day I left, it spiked to over 300 on their scale.
Whoa.
And that's called hazardous, where you're not even supposed to be outside breathing. It's got like the worst of the 2.5 micron particulates that go right into your lungs and stay there forever, and it's horrible. N95 masks or P95 masks, if it's a 300-plus day, it's hazardous to breathe that air. And I was in a terminal looking across the runway to another terminal. I couldn't see the other terminal.
Right.
It was like, it's not fog. That's pollution. And it's like, on days like that, you really do have to wear some sort of breathing protection. And so a lot of folks, if you live and work there for any length of time, you get some cool custom mask. And I think people have seen these too, where you get like the biker style, where it's the kind of a wraparound where you can have cool designs on your face and things like that, or like a skull and crossbones or... But I think the marketing, though, for dust masks, just the disposable, like N95 or the P95, that do a little more protection. There's all kinds of marketing that should be going on for those in terms of putting slogans or a happy face on them or something to encourage people to wear them. Especially the airport workers. I saw very few airport workers outside wearing those masks or anything sufficient. And a lot of them knew better than to just be out there huffing and puffing. They made their way toward the...
Sounds like something out of Transmetropolitan. The
inside the airports, you're fine, because it's also filtered and, you know, it's relatively nice, but... also
be careful.
Yeah. And no bringing lighters or matches on any flights in China, so don't bring your favorite lighter with you. Please.
skateboard.
I mean, oh, there are truckloads of disposable lighters left at the entrances to every Chinese airport, which is a statement in and of itself. But
that's pretty funny.
But
oh my goodness, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, I too could keep talking and ramble on about everything and anything. But yeah,
I like to ramble. So Thursday the 17th, we're going to do a hangout. We'll send you a link to that. We're going to do our next hangout the day after Black Friday. That's Saturday, 11/26. As always, ask at avxl.com. Fire out your Black Friday questions. Fire out your touring in China questions. Fire out your Blu-ray movie, HD audio, audiophile, speaker, AV surround sound, television, you name it. We're interested in hearing about it. Westworld is getting weirder. Anthony Bourdain Parts Unknown is the closest thing you're going to get to Robert's Chinese food experience without leaving the comfort of your remote control. And thank you, each and every one of you. The website is not TEKTHIG.com. AVXL.com. Hair Infidelity. .com is another good one. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Herron.
We'll see you next week. Actually, we'll see you later this week.
Yes.
Yes.
We're on a mission.
We're on a mission from God. If you can name the movie that's from and the two principal actors in the band they were in, we will send you a glorious personalized email. or I'll find something out of the box of junk over there and we'll sign it and send it to you.
I want to say that was the first thing I saw on HBO when HBO debuted.
Don't spoil it.
That's the
AVXL.com. See you guys later this week.